Welcome to the Human Factors and Ergonomics Hub, a series of educational podcasts that showcase the connection between human capabilities and good work design, brought to you by the Human Factors and Ergonomics Society of Australia. Hi, I'm Sharon Todd, the current president of the Human Factors and Ergonomics Society of Australia, and today I'm chatting with Professor Philip Morgan, who recently spoke at the Human Factors and Ergonomics Society of New Zealand's conference. So today's podcast is brought to you in conjunction with the Human Factors and Ergonomics Society of New Zealand. Professor Philip Morgan holds a personal chair in the Human Factors and Cognitive Science within the School of Psychology at Cardiff University, UK. He is director and co-founder of the Human Factors Excellence Research Group and director of research for the Centre for AI, Robotics and Human-Machine Systems. Philip works on large-scale projects funded by Airbus, is the technical lead in cyberpsychology and human factors, and is head of the Airbus Accelerator in Human-Centric Cybersecurity.
Thank you for joining us.
An absolute pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
That's okay. So in our discussions at the Human Factors and Ergonomics New Zealand conference, where we've spent the last couple of days talking about various human factors matters, you have suggested that some of the future issues for HFE include not only artificial intelligence but also cybersecurity. So my question really is, what is the difference between the two, or how are they connected?
Okay, this is a really good question. It's a broad one. So a lot of people will have heard about or be hearing about artificial intelligence. It's become a huge subject area. You know, artificial intelligence is not new. It's been around for some time, but it's never, ever been so advanced. And over the last sort of 5 years in particular, the advancements in artificial intelligence technology have been absolutely huge. So, for example, when we hear about things like ChatGPT and various other systems that are able to arguably, in my view, you know, provide better answers and solutions than humans can when they're asked particular questions. So, for example, as an academic, you know, there's an argument that if you ask something like ChatGPT to write a journal paper, whereas I would normally write that journal paper myself, apparently those kind of systems could do it better than a human, so better than I can. So with artificial intelligence, it's got a number of potentially massive benefits to healthcare systems, financial technology, smart cities, the way we go about life, making our lives a heck of a lot easier. But there are a number of potential downsides as well. So when I just gave the example of artificial intelligence being able to, like, maybe write an academic or come up with an academic journal article like one I could write, there are issues with it. It's not perfect. It's not perfect. And some people believe that it is perfect. So it's probably best if I go on to explain what kind of artificial intelligence is from my viewpoint. So I'm not an artificial intelligence expert in terms of I'm not a computer scientist. I'm a psychologist, a human factors psychologist by trade. But there is a clear distinction between what we know as artificial intelligence and what we probably know more as machine learning. And there's also data analytics approaches. So machine learning is where you program a system essentially with a set of rules, a set of algorithms, and it solves problems for you. It kind of goes through the algorithms and it can process things a lot quicker than we can as humans and come up with solutions. But it's not, it is clever, but it's not clever like a human is. It can't go beyond the boundaries of what it's programmed to do. One of the differences with artificial intelligence is the idea is it thinks, it adapts like a human. So with artificial intelligence, it can come up with solutions that it's learning, like we learn. So artificial intelligence can learn. Now, a lot of people abandon around the term artificial intelligence when actually they mean machine learning or they mean data science. So artificial intelligence is something different. And the original kind of Alan Turing test, so Alan Turing came up with the term, you know, many, many decades ago, was that if, as humans, we cannot distinguish between an AI system and a human, we've therefore passed the Turing test. The Turing test means that we don't know whether it's human or not anymore. The way cybersecurity comes into this, so cybersecurity is highly related, it's not the same thing, but because of the development and proliferation of artificial intelligence and machine learning and all these other things, most if not all of these systems are connected to the internet. Anything that's connected to the internet is at risk of being cyber attacked. So there are very, very clever people out there who can develop all sorts of techniques to cyber attack a system. They might be trying to steal your bank details, your personal information, or they might be looking to take down the critical national infrastructure of a country. The reason it's such a problem when it comes to artificial intelligence is because artificial intelligence is developing so rapidly and proliferating across every aspect of our lives, of the phones that we use to speak to people, medical devices, manufacturing equipment, and as I said, even systems now that you can speak to and ask questions of, and it can ask questions of you. The risks of a successful cyber attack happening have never, ever been so high. They are astronomical. So part of our job and part of a lot of people's job is to try and better understand as humans what are our human risks when it comes to succumbing to a cyber attack attempt when you're interacting with an artificial intelligence system. And as humans, some people say as humans that we're prone to make mistakes, we're silly, some people say we're stupid. I don't believe any of that. I don't think we're stupid at all. Yeah, sometimes we make mistakes, we're fallible. You know, we've got fallible attention, perception, memory, and so on. But when it comes to things like risky decision making and making decisions around cyber, sometimes we make mistakes. And it's actually the case that 95% of successful cyber attacks, they get into the systems because of us, the humans. So when you couple AI with cyber, and AI is a massive platform for cyber attacks to impact, and then you see the figures that 90 to 95% of successful cyber attacks are let in by us humans, there I think we can see where the big problem is. So we really need to understand what the human vulnerabilities are regarding cybersecurity to better educate people, to better support people, so we reduce the risk of bad things happening, and we use AI for the greater good, because it's been developed for the greater good.
Okay, so cybersecurity is more than hacking.
Way more than hacking, yeah.
Okay, so what are some of the cybersecurity risks in real terms? Because I think some of us just dig our head into the sand and think it'll never happen.
Yeah, so, I mean, a lot of people will, you know, I think a number of people have probably, to some extent, experienced a sort of cyber issue. So, you know, even during the conference, I've been talking to some people who, for example, were looking to tax their road vehicle so that it's legal to drive on the road. And they were sent, this person was sent a reminder by arguably the government agency who taxed his vehicle. It wasn't the government agency. It was a malevolent actor who was looking to get the bank details entered, steal the bank details, could steal all sorts of other things. Hacking is an example of where people will hack into our personal systems or company systems, or, you know, some threat states and state actors will try and hack into government systems and all those kind of things as well. And yeah, you can hack, you can send through all sorts of, you know, really, really horrible, unpleasant cyber software, if you like. But it's not just hacking. We've got phishing, for example, phishing with a PH, not phishing with a reel, where every time you open an email, it's the case these days that possibly one in every 20 emails is not genuine. It's fake. It's been generated by somebody else. And you're, through various cues, you're being asked to engage with this email in some way, not just read it. You might be asked to click a link to go and, you know, go off and you've won a competition or something like that. There might be an attachment in there that could have come potentially from your employer to say, you know, you're at risk of losing your job. If you open this file, you can fill out the details and it's going to minimise the chances of losing your job and various other things. But these phishing attempts, they're called methods of persuasion. I call them weapons of influence. There are a number of key things that will lure people into engaging with these emails and then clicking the link or opening the attachment or doing something, and then essentially the cyber attack starts happening. So some of the biggest things, and it comes as no surprise, we've known this from sort of psychology for a number of years, there are a number of cues to malevolence in phishing emails, but not very many people know what they are. The threat actors know they are because they're developing the cyber attacks. So for example, authority is one of the biggest cues. So I gave a work example. And with authority, if you're working in a job and you get an email from the CEO, the company director of your organization, to say that, you know, you're all getting a pay rise. Everybody's getting a pay rise. A 20% pay rise is happening. We're all having a meeting at 4 o'clock this afternoon. You need to click on the link to say that you're coming to the meeting because we need to organize catering. So there's an authority figure there saying you've got to come, you've got to do these kind of things. And the only way you can come is to click on the link. You're about 85% more likely to click on a link or open the attachment if it comes from an authority person. It could be a doctor, it could be just somebody that you've got a huge amount of respect for. And then things like curiosity, and curiosity is a big thing. I've been looking at curiosity for a while. People are using very, very clever techniques within emails, using psycholinguistic properties and various other things to make you curious about what they're asking you about. You know, this is a really, I've been selected to do something, and I've been selected for particular reasons to do this thing, so I want to know more. So I'll click on the link to find out more. And then there are other cues, like scarcity of information. So you've just been sent an email by your boss, and it just says, meet me, 5 p.m, my office. Click the link. And because it's scarce information, you're thinking, well, I need to click the link. Maybe I need to book an appointment. Maybe I need to find out what this is. And then when you couple these things, if you couple authority with scarcity and curiosity, then you're really, really most vulnerable. And then on top of that, you've got things. So, for example, some of my PhD students at the moment, one in particular, George Raywood-Burke, he's finishing his PhD over the next month or so, has been looking at the effects of cognitive pressures and time pressures and workload pressures and those kind of things. So you've got these weapons of influence that can work. They can really, really encourage people to click on things they shouldn't be clicking on. But when you're working under time pressure, and that could be subjective time pressure. You know, you've got 5 minutes to finish a task and you need to access a file. So this will give you another example of a way of a cyber attack getting into a system. You need to access a file. If you don't submit this document by 5 p.m, the last month's work you've done was a waste of time. Now, that file is on a USB stick. You know you shouldn't put that USB stick into your laptop because it could have a virus on it, but you've got 5 minutes to submit this report you've been working on for a month. A lot of people will plug in that USB stick. And then you fulfill your goal. And then afterwards, you might ask yourself, should I have plugged in the USB stick? But before you know it, the cyber attack has happened.
So when we talk about a cyber attack, what actually is happening when we click that link?
So it can be small scale to really, really, really large scale. So a small scale kind of thing can be where through various kind of, you know, complicated and sometimes not so complicated software, something gets into your computer system that has been programmed to kind of scrape your computer system to try and find details about maybe your bank account number, your personal identification, national insurance number, your address, all of these kind of things. So that, you know, that kind of relatively, I say simply, they are very complicated to program, but the people who know how to program them, they can kind of do it standing on their head. So that can be there to just scrape some of your personal information, maybe to get at some of your money, some of your details, even some of your details, just so you can be spammed with marketing campaigns and things like that. So it's not always, you know, super, super malevolent and awful kind of world-ending stuff. But that, at the other end of the spectrum, you've got cyber attacks that can enter systems where they're designed to take down critical national infrastructure. They're designed to take down power plants, hospitals, road networks, air traffic control centres, all these kind of things. And we can, you know, just with the examples that I've given there, the consequences of one of those getting in, just to one place in one town or city in one country, could be absolutely catastrophic. And people out there are a lot of people in the world who've got the capabilities to do it. So we've got a lot of fantastic people across the world researching these things. We've got wonderful computer systems and virus protection software and hardware protection software, and people are doing a brilliant job to protect what, you know, what we regard as really, really important. But the malevolent actors, the cyber attackers, they're becoming cleverer and cleverer and cleverer, and they're better understanding what those systems are, and we are sometimes only two or three steps ahead. So we've got to remain ahead. But as part of that, our job then as human factors, psychologists and ergonomists, I can never say the word properly, but ergs people and psychologists and various other people, is to try and minimise the likelihood that we as humans are going to engage in some of these techniques that are being used to get into the systems. Because a lot of the things will get into the systems, things will get into the systems without a human needing to click anything or do anything. But the easiest target for the cyber criminals are the humans. That's the easiest way to get in. So that's where they'll attack the most, through an email, through whatever it is. And once you've clicked on something, you've opened something, you've allowed something to download, then it can proliferate throughout the whole system.
So how do we stop this, or how do we manage this via human factors and ergonomics?
So maybe up until about 20 years ago, so cyber's been, it's been an issue, you know, since the advent of the internet and connectivity and all these kind of things. And I think a number of folks, maybe even up until 20, 15 years ago, figured that we just need clever computer software to essentially, it's a word I don't like using, but it's a word that's used within cybersecurity, to kill the cyber attack. We kill it with software. So we fight software with software, essentially. But we know that these things are getting through. They're getting through. You know, people are being cyber attacked day in, day out. Companies, organizations, big organizations, small organizations. And without the right levels of protection from the software, you know, some companies can't afford some of the expensive software, or maybe they don't see it as a priority, or whatever else. The cyber attacks, they are going to get in. They're going to get in. So it was only about 20 years ago, some very influential papers by Angela Sasse, who was at UCL, University College London at the time, started to really, really stress that we need to better understand human psychological vulnerabilities when it comes to engaging with online systems that could be cyber attacked. And this kind of takes us back then to things like risky decision making, judgment under uncertainty, and various other aspects of sort of cognitive science and social cognition. But a lot of human factors issues come into play, like workload, you know, how much workload pressure are we under, fatigues, are we tired, we're more likely to do something that could be a bit impulsive without thinking it through when we're tired. So you've got fatigue, you've got situation awareness. Is our situation awareness good enough? So situation awareness being our understanding of the current situation, where we've been recently in the past and where we're going in the near future. If our situation awareness is, for whatever reason, a little bit out of sync, we might be, you know, very, very highly workload, very stressed or whatever else, we are at an even greater risk. So we need to understand the psychological aspects of human cyber risks so that we can then better educate people, increase awareness, develop software systems that can better support them. But human factors plays a massive role in that, and in some of the areas that I just mentioned, like workload, situation awareness, and lots of areas related to that. And the way we measure things as well, the methods that we use in human factors to, for example, task analyses and hierarchical task analyses to really, really understand if and when these things occur, when a human engages in something that could result in a successful cyber attack happening or does result in a successful cyber attack, let's try and work out exactly what the factors were that led to that so we can better understand, you know, was it a bit of this? Was it a bit of fatigue? Was it a bit of misunderstanding? Was it this, that, and whatever else? So that we can better understand why people are engaging in these risky behaviours, and then we can develop more effective solutions rather than saying, and this has been happening all too often for 20 years, a number of myself and a number of colleagues in and around the world, and lots of academics and other experts working on this, say training alone doesn't work. You can get somebody in a room, you can present them with a PowerPoint slide deck for an hour to say, these are the threats, you know, this is what you need to look out for, don't do this, and you think, right, this is great, this is wonderful. You might remember 25% of that information. In a week's time, you might remember 5% of it. 2 weeks later, you've forgotten it all. So training alone just doesn't work. So we need to do more, we need to go further.
Did we see an increase in cybersecurity crime and risks during COVID when people were at home?
It was astronomically bigger than ever. It was almost like the perfect storm, the perfect platform for cyber criminals. So people bring in their work devices home. So people working in organisations where sometimes, you know, yeah, then you might be able to bring a work laptop home or a work phone in some organisations. But imagine sort of safety critical organisations where for whatever reason, you know, during the pandemic, you had to work from home, even if it's 1 day a week, 2 days a week, 3 days a week, or you're on lockdown or whatever it was, you had to bring your, you know, your really highly secure devices home with your password protection and all these different verification things. And the cyber criminals knew that. It was a perfect opportunity for them to really, really go to town. So they were trying to develop even more sophisticated ways of attacking those systems. But it wasn't new during COVID. So COVID, I think, allowed a platform for quite a long period of time, obviously, for people to try out these techniques to try and attack these systems. But they were already doing this when people were away from work and maybe their higher level of cyber protection in the organisations they work in, when they were travelling for work, so travelling on a train, travelling on a plane and those kind of things. So the cyber criminals already, you know, sort of knew what they needed to do and what they could do when people were out of the kind of secure zone of their work environments, particularly if they work in safety critical areas or, you know, areas of national security and all those kind of things. But yeah, the COVID pandemic meant that so many people were working from home, taking their work systems home with them, and that presented a massive challenge. And I know a number of organizations, including organizations I work with and organizations I've worked for in the past, they really, really upped their games. They had to. They had to invest so much into trying to protect their employees at home, because it's about protecting the employee. Of course, it's about protecting business and the organization, but most organizations, and I'm a firm believer in this, most organizations do value their employees as well. They don't want them to be cyber attacked. It presented a massive challenge.
So what did they do? Did they devise software or buy software? What did they do?
So software already, kind of existed, and software's always been developed literally every day, every week. There are new versions of virus protection software coming out, new levels of protection on systems. But what a lot of the larger companies had to do at the time was up things even more to try and protect things. Verification is one way of doing that, and I think verification is fantastic. We might find it irritating when we go about our everyday lives. You want to get onto online banking, you've got to put in a code, then another code, then you get a text message, an SMS to put in, and we forget our passwords, and that's a bit of an issue as well. So the levels of verification, that certainly increased a lot, where you had to go through even more channels than you ever did in the past to do these things, and people had to be a bit more savvy as well. You know, organizations were telling their employees, you know, you need to be a bit more savvy. Don't just connect to a Wi-Fi hotspot where you might be sort of in your local area, you're working from home, and you want to go and do some work in a cafe. Don't connect to the cafe internet. We know you might want to connect to the cafe internet, or don't take your device in the first place. But if you are going to take your device, maybe have your coffee, have your piece of cake, do your work when you're there. But don't reconnect to the internet and send that email until you get back home to your network and you've got your verification systems there as well. But a lot of people weren't aware of this. They weren't aware of this. You know, they were just being told, be vigilant, be careful, because things could get bad. We didn't see, I mean, existential risks. We know existential risks are there. A lot of people said we didn't see COVID come in. We didn't see it come in, but there was always a chance that a global pandemic was going to work. And a number of organizations weren't really that prepared for that. But now I think, you know, to put a positive spin on that, with these existential risks like pandemics, I think now they're even more ready to respond if something occurs in the future.
So what should governments be doing about this?
Governments, for example, UK government, I'm based in the UK in Cardiff University. The UK government takes cybersecurity incredibly seriously, massively serious, and a number of governments in the world are doing the same. So they're invested a lot of money and a lot of resource, not only into trying to develop and provide, but also support organisations to develop, you know, the best software in the world, and to, you know, educate the best people so that they can work in these areas. But they're also setting up and have set up fantastic organisations like subdivisions within government. I don't mean division as a division, but like, for example, in the UK we have something called the GCHQ, the Government Communications Headquarters, which is very, very famous. And as part of GCHQ, we've had for almost, I think it's 10 years, the National Cyber Security Centre. And these folks are a fantastic team of people who are dedicated to protecting the UK and other countries, allied countries, but protecting the UK against the threat of cyber attacks. And I can never remember the exact slogan, but I should. But it's basically protecting people to work effectively, whether they're at home, whether they're at work, whether they're in between work and home, through the guidance and support and the training and the awareness that they provide. And a lot of people working within that organisation are computer scientists, they're socio-technical psychologists, sociologists, people who've got experience in criminology, a really diverse range of people. And that's what we need. That's what we need. We can't just have one discipline trying to address this area. Many years ago, you know, it was thought of as, this is a problem for computer scientists. And computer scientists are massively important in this. You know, they are the ones who develop the software who can kill the cyber attacks, but all of these other disciplines are massively important. So yeah, government have got, I think, a lot of responsibility when it comes to cyber, and a number of the governments in the world are doing a fantastic job. They're investing so much money and so much resource into it, and they know that they need to carry on doing that. But it's not the same throughout the world. You know, it will vary depending on country. To country, but there are kind of large forums across the world as well where governments get together to talk about these problems. It's a world problem. It's a global issue. Nobody really wants any country to be cyber attacked and for the critical national infrastructure to be taken down, and it would be catastrophic. So it's a global challenge, and a lot of governments, you know, through things like G7 and various other things, they collaborate very, very closely with each other to try and address these problems.
I think this is probably a lot bigger than we realise, because I think there's many individuals that would be attached, have their details attached to a phishing site or whatever it is. And then I guess the question is, what does an individual do if they have been attacked in some
form? So that's a really interesting question. So, you know, in the past, I guess, when somebody has realised that they've been cyber attacked, you know, your screen has gone red, you've got a message on there, you've got a ransomware attack saying that your computer is now locked, we've got your details, you need to pay us, you know, $1,000 immediately, otherwise we take, you know, we take other things, is try not to panic at that point. Yeah, it's bad. It's bad. It's not a good situation. Have a look for information on the internet, like the government support guidelines on what to do about these kind of things. As I said, I mentioned the National Cybersecurity Centre in the UK, and I know there are similar organisations throughout the world. Those organisations have been established to help people to get through those kind of situations through various like playbooks. So you can go through different playbooks that are available on websites on how you deal with this situation at this point in time, rather than sort of clicking things and panicking and paying the ransomware or whatever it is. Have a look at some of the resources that are available, because there could be there often will be a solution there that will help you out at that point in time. One of my biggest bits of advice is don't panic. Yeah, it's not great that it's happened, but it can be put right. On some scales, or when we get to the larger scales, you know, when a cyber attack comes in and it hits maybe a large organization, for example, they'll have their own processes and procedures for dealing with these kind of things, and they have to report these things to the relevant authorities like National Cybersecurity Centre in the UK. It's a lot more complicated than a ransomware attack on an individual's laptop. It could involve, for example, shutting down production in that company for 2 weeks, a month, 6 weeks, 2 months. It could spell the end of the business. Yeah.
Okay. In the last couple of days, I've heard you talk about automated and autonomous vehicles, and you've also suggested that cybersecurity could affect autonomous vehicles. Let's talk about that.
It's a really, really interesting topic area, and a bit like psychological and human factors issues surrounding cybersecurity in general 20 years ago, not very many people are talking about it. So I think one of the issues we've got, so I've been looking at research into human factors associated with autonomous vehicles for about 10 years. About 7 years ago, I was working on a project where it was called the Flourish Project, funded by Innovate UK, a wonderful project, a really, really great collaboration with a number of organisations. And part of our job as part of the project was to develop a human-machine interface, a dashboard for future autonomous vehicles. So autonomous vehicles that can drive themselves in most or all situations. So really highly autonomous, really sophisticated tech. What we realised when we were designing this dashboard is, if you've got an autonomous vehicle, the autonomous vehicle is going to be a connected autonomous vehicle. So instead of an AV, it'll be a CAV, a CAV. And it doesn't necessarily just need to be an autonomous vehicle. Lots of our vehicles are connected now in some ways. And once it's connected, once anything is connected, it can be cyber attacked. So we sat back and we were designing guidelines and recommendations for this particular HMI and dashboard, and we realised that this is prone to being cyber attacked. And then that got us thinking about what are the implications. Okay, so we've got this kind of, for folks who know, not everybody will know this, but you can look it up, the Die Hard 4 situation, I think it is. So Bruce Willis in Die Hard 4, the bad guys, they turn all the lights in a city centre to red or green. If it's green, all the cars go at the same time. If it's red, everything stops. And that got me thinking about 7 or 8 years ago, well, if a cyber attack can hit an autonomous vehicle, which it would be able to if it's connected, that autonomous vehicle is connected to other autonomous vehicles because they're speaking to each other through, you know, all different sensor technology and connectivity. That is probably then connected to a traffic control center who's monitoring, you know, the people in there are monitoring all the autonomous vehicles in a network. That could then be connected to something else. And then when you start looking at it and you develop this chain, ultimately they will be connected to the critical national infrastructure of the country. So you get a cyber attack hitting an autonomous vehicle. Within seconds, minutes, or days, that could affect the entire transport system. If we've got connected infrastructure, traffic lights, the Die Hard 4 situation again, just getting in through that vehicle could turn all the lights to green in a city in another part of the country. So it's a massive, massive issue. But not many people are investigating the human factors side of potential cyber attacks on connected autonomous vehicles. And it's very, very worrying. So I've got PhD students at the moment and researchers working on this. And one of my PhD students, I'll use this as an example, Victoria Marcinkovic. She's doing a fantastic PhD on human cyber vulnerabilities whilst using autonomous vehicles. And one of the things she's found in some of her early studies is that a lot of people really don't seem to understand what cybersecurity means in terms of autonomous vehicles. So if you ask people a simple question about how much do you value the features of a vehicle, people will normally say, you know, in terms of the most important features to them, they'll say roadworthiness, safety, reliability, and these kind of things. And you think, right, cyber's got to be big. Cyber's rated as the least important factor, even next to design. So design of the seats and the doors and the shape of the car at the moment to a lot of people, because they don't, a lot of people don't fully understand what cybersecurity means. It's just another thing. It's just another thing. And to a lot of people, cyber means something to do with the internet. Cyber is something to do with the internet, that maybe my infotainment system in the car, you know, that's cyber because it's connected to this, that, and whatever else. So one of the things Victoria's realised, and we've been, you know, we've been doing research on this, is through better educating people about the terminology and what this actually means and what could happen if a successful cyber attack gets into an autonomous vehicle. It's really, really great that this has happened. It causes a shift in cognition to thinking this is a really serious issue. This is a really serious issue. And yeah, she's doing some fantastic work at the moment. We're presenting papers in various conferences. We got a paper in the Applied Human Factors and Ergonomics Conference in San Francisco at the end of July on this topic. And I'd recommend to anybody to read the paper. It's on essentially cybersecurity readiness, preparedness, of autonomous vehicle technology, and then how companies respond to cyber attacks and how, as humans, we interact with that technology. And then also, if a cyber attack does occur, hypothetically, these are hypothetical situations, what does that do to our trust in the technology? What's it do in terms of blame? If something happens, who do we blame? Do we blame the company? Do we blame the government? Do we blame who do we blame? And ultimately, one of the issues there as well, apart from the massive safety issues and various other things, are if there is a successful cyber attack on an autonomous vehicle and I'm using that autonomous vehicle, could that actually mean that I never want to use an autonomous vehicle ever again? Do I want to go back to a non-connected autonomous vehicle? So there's a big question to be answered there, you know, for the future of what could be a fantastic technology, a game changer. We've already got the technology, and it is a game changer. But the cybersecurity threats that are out there could undermine that game changer. So we've got to be two steps ahead.
That's a really significant thing when you think about the ability to sort of shut a city down or turn the city on and have total chaos. I mean, we've seen what's happened, haven't we, with terrorist attacks in cities, and but this is so much bigger than that. So, yes, I can understand that it would be important for these criminals to get that information. It's a bit terrifying, really. It's much bigger than hacking into my bank account.
It is. It's very, very terrifying. And another thing that I find, you know, quite terrifying about this whole thing is not everybody is out there to cyber attack systems to cause damage. There are a lot of very, very clever people out there right across the world who basically want to show off to organisations who may sponsor them to do those kind of things what they can do. So there's a number of individuals out there who will, you know, some of these people are, you know, teenagers who are brilliant programmers, absolutely brilliant programmers, and they want to show maybe, you know, maybe a trustworthy organization, I can attack this system and I can take it down. So therefore, you might want to employ me because I am a brilliant programmer and I can do this, that, and whatever else. But before they know it, what they've done is in the hands of the malevolent actors, or they themselves become malevolent actors, because this is a big money game. You know, so not everybody is going to be influenced by this, thankfully. You know, I think human nature can be fantastic. But when you've got somebody who's got the capability to develop some of these sophisticated cyber attack techniques, and then all of a sudden somebody in their own country or another part of the world says, we will pay you significant amounts of money to come and work for us to attack a country's critical national infrastructure, and then they name their figure, for some people it can be tempted. I'd like to think for most people it's not, but for some people it can be tempting, and that is what's happening. That's kind of what's happening out there, and that's a massive worry.
So is this out of control, or is there something that can be done?
So sometimes I lie awake at night, and sometimes I'll wake up in the middle of the night and think it is completely out of control. You know, it's kind of like almost this doomsday sort of scenario that we've got this kind of silent war that's happening. We can't even see it. And one day we're all going to wake up and all the lights are going to be off and no cars are going to be running and hospitals are going to be closed and it's going to be chaos. But I then kind of think, you know, like, The cybersecurity threats, they've been around for a number of decades. Yes, we've experienced some significant cyber attacks throughout the world. We've experienced smaller scale cyber attacks, personal cyber attacks, and so on. But so far, and I know this sounds maybe like a sort of silly answer, we haven't seen cities being taken down. We haven't seen, yeah, we've seen attacks on hospitals. But usually, like, for example, there was an attack in the UK on the NHS, and everybody got they got really rewarded. They said the NHS has been attacked, you know, by a cyber. What's going on? And it turns out that the software that they were using, it's not the fault of the NHS. It was a funding issue and whatever else. They were using older software. It was older software. It just wasn't as up to date as it needed to be. With the up to date software, the cyber attack wouldn't have got in. So if we, as I think I've said a number of times, if we stay two or three steps ahead, I think we can all sleep well at night in terms of thinking we've got brilliant minds, we've got brilliant computer scientists, we've got brilliant human factors people, psychologists, sociologists, legal technology folks out there who are trying to stay two steps ahead. And yes, it is a war. It is a war between us and the cyber criminals. At the moment, we're winning. And if more and more investment is put into this space, and it needs to be put into this space, we can carry on winning. But do I think that it's inevitable that something big will happen maybe over the next 5 or 10 years in terms of a big, large-scale cyber attack? I'd love to say no, but I'd probably have to say probably. Probably have to say probably. Two probablys in one sentence, not very good. It's, yeah, the technology is so sophisticated, the people are so clever. So we have to be ready for that. We have to be ready for one of the big things at the moment, and I've been involved in a lot of work regarding this, is in the past and in the not too distant past, a lot of the focus had been on, and it is kind of still on, how do we prevent a cyber attack from happening? So it's all about preparedness and prevention. Now a lot of countries and organisations within those countries know that it's inevitable that the cyber attacks are going to happen. So now it's more to do with how we respond. So when it happens, how do we respond to it so we minimise the damage that's caused? Because it's going to happen. And it is happening. So, yeah, there's a lot more focus with a number of the kind of organisations I work with in universities across the world on, we've still got to focus on preparedness, we've got to develop the best systems, we've got to do this, but we've also got to work out what happens, you know, when that kind of bomb goes off, if you like. How do we minimise the casualties? How do we try and, you know, how do we try and clean things up so it's done the minimum damage it possibly can? And then how do we learn from that so it doesn't happen again? Or if it does happen again, we're ready for it. So there's a lot of learning to be done, a lot of black box thinking, a lot of future thinking kind of approaches to hypothetical scenarios and working through those scenarios. And, you know, folks should realise as well, I know that not everybody will realise this. I didn't realise this up until maybe 6 or 7 years ago, that we've got, you know, within organisations, a lot of the large organisations we know, we've got security operation team specialists who are there 24 hours a day monitoring the cyberspace, like air traffic controllers monitor the skies, we've got people there who are monitoring the cyberspace and they are watching for everything. And that should help people sleep at night to know that there are specialists out there. They're probably killing thousands of cyber attacks every single day that we never hear about. But yeah, sometimes some slip through.
It could be a good place to end. The question I was, and I know that you've talked about PhD students. One of my, I just wanted to bring it back to a human factors question, if I can. And I guess the question is, are the human factors professionals equipped to deal with this currently?
It's a really good question, and I think it's best to answer it by giving an example. So in 2018, I was working as a full-time academic in the School of Psychology at Cardiff University in the UK, and I was doing a lot of work with an organisation, a large aerospace company at the time, I was approached and asked as a human factor specialist who'd only sort of been working on cyber, we call it cyber psychology now within human factors. As a cyber psychology expert, can you do a domain analysis, a state of the art appraisal of our systems and our people and the various things we do? And can you, you know, the 90 to 95% of successful cyber attacks have a human at the kind of door letting it in? Is there something we can do about that? Can we learn from human factors? Can we learn from psychology to try and minimise that? And I said, yeah, we 100% we can. And I was asked, it was like, so why are you so confident? Because almost immediately I said, we can. And I said, as human factors professionals, myself as a psychologist and a human factors professional, I said, we've been doing it for 150 years. You know, the aviation domain is one of the safest ways to travel in the world. One of the reasons for that is because of human factors psychologists, because the systems have been designed, redeveloped based upon principles that have been developed by human factors professionals and other people throughout the world to make it the safest systems in the world. And I said, I'm not going to say that it's easy, but what I am going to say is I and my team, we can draw upon 150 years of psychology research, 50, 60 years of human factors research, and try and understand, try and use what we already understand and apply it to a new context. Because cyber, and I don't mean this, I don't mean to play it down, cyber is just a new context. It's another context. So, you know, when people said in the past, okay, we've got the internet, well, that's a new context. We've got potentially driverless cars, that's a new context. And you can apply what you learn. So it's one example I like to give my students when I'm teaching my students about this is Formula One racing. You know, it's huge. It's a multi-billion pound industry. Lots of people love Formula One racing. One of the reasons why Formula One is so successful and the cars are so effective and the way, you know, these mechanics get new tyres on the cars within about 8 seconds or whatever it is, it's because they learn from the aviation domain how the aviation domain do these things, and the aviation domain largely based their procedures and their methodologies and everything else on what human factors experts had told them. So if Formula One racing are doing it, they're doing it in healthcare environments. To me, why is cybersecurity any different? Yet there are different challenges. There are some different challenges there, but some of the things are quite similar. So when I've kind of sort of spoken in the past, you know, it's like, why are humans susceptible to being cyber attacked? Well, we're human. Some individuals might have a higher risk-taking propensity than others. Some people might be a bit more impulsive than others. Personality, some people might be more extroverted, and that might encourage them to engage with somebody in a cyber attack attempt more than somebody who's introverted. So we can learn the lessons of what we know about individual differences and all these different factors and stress and situation awareness and fatigue and workload and those kind of things and try and apply them to this domain. And so far, we've been, you know, myself and my team, we've been doing this for, it must be coming up to about 8 years, and we're within organisations for about four and a half years. We're having a lot of success. One example I'll give is we've developed a tool. So one of my other PhD students, Laura Bishop, myself and some other colleagues. Laura's going to be finishing her PhD. Well, she's finished her PhD. She's going to be Vivid in 2 weeks' time. She's developed a tool that can account for up to 65% of the reasons for why humans engage in cyber risky behaviour. There's nothing else like it in the world. In the past, we had tools that could account for maybe 20% of the reasons why we engage in cyber risky behavior. So not only do we have the tools where we can basically run these tools with people to show them what their cyber vulnerabilities are, we also know what most of that 35% of the unexplained variance is. And they're predominantly human factors issues, stress, workload, fatigue. So we need to tackle those problems. And then with these tools, these kind of screening, I'm not so keen on the word screening, but it is a screening tool. You're screening for cyber vulnerabilities. If we've got the best tools, and then we understand the human factors issues that go alongside that, we can inform and educate organizations to be better, to work better, smarter and in cleverer ways to do these things. So imagine using one of these tools where, you know, some people might see it as, I don't want to be screened, I don't want to know what my cyber vulnerabilities are. But if you knew what they are, you can then have a decision support system or a training and awareness campaign that can be developed for you to support you to work safer. And we do this in ergonomics all the time. You know, we're all very, very happy that when we go into a workplace environment, in most workplace environments, not all, unfortunately, you know, somebody says to us, we need a chair that fits you. You need a chair that supports your back. It supports your arms. It supports your wrists, you know, so that you don't do yourself physical damage. And to me, why is cyber any different? I personally, if I went into a new organization and somebody said, we want to know what your cyber strengths are and your cyber vulnerabilities, I'd say, go for it. Let's find out what they are so that I can better understand what my cyber vulnerabilities are. And then I'm aware of it. And I can also have maybe a decision support system, some kind of avatar that sits on my device or even a little post-it note by the side of my laptop to say, apparently, that when you do behavior X, you're likely to then engage in Y, and Y is bad. And just seeing that, it might just cause you to stop and think for 2 or 3 seconds. And you think, do you know what? I'm not going to click on that link. I'm going to actually verify that the person who sent that email is real. So I'm going to phone the company. And then they say, no, we didn't send you that email. Cyber attack on the way. So yeah, being able to understand more about ourselves and what our cyber risks are, and then having tools to support us to work safer, I think is one of the most important areas when it comes to cybersecurity. As I said, I think previously, the technological developments that are happening to protect us, they are phenomenal. But the weakest link in the chain, unfortunately, is still us. We are the weakest link. The humans are the weakest link. But I do strongly believe that we can be one of the strongest links in the cybersecurity chain. But we need human factors experts and lots of people who work with human factors experts to drive us to that level. We're human, and I think I've said this a number of times. People say that we can be silly, we can be irrational. And yes, these things can happen, but we don't have to be. We really, really don't have to be. So we can fight back. We can fight back to the point maybe where cyber criminals, you know, at some point in the future, maybe this is a utopian dream, we'll think, do you know what, it's not worth doing this anymore because everybody is so aware and they're so understanding. But if we can get even halfway there, I think we will have done a fantastic job. But we need more specialists. We need more people trained in this area. It's a big job. It's a big task. We need more great minds coming from all sorts of disciplines.
The views expressed by Professor Philip Morgan within the HFESA podcast are his own and not those of any organisation he works for or with, or linked to any project he works on, past or present. Thanks for joining us at the Human Factors and Ergonomics Hub, brought to you by the Human Factors and Ergonomics Society of Australia, where human-centred design really matters. If you like this podcast, make us your favourite in your podcast app. We look forward to chatting with you next time.